Hello, and thanks for coming out. Thanks, Joan, Chris. I'm going to read some prose. I'm not a prose writer, but I've been working on a memoir for 5 years, and it's driving me nuts. So first thing I'm going to read is the first chapter, and it's about my mother, and this chapter takes place 3 days before she died. It's called Get This Body Out of Here, January 25th, 2019. Jay, Jay, my mother howled from the back bedroom. I woke and ran in to find her coiled in a fetal position at the foot of her bed. You better get this body out of here, she commanded. I died an hour ago. I was about to reach out to touch her, to brush her hair away from her face and try to calm her. Instead, I pulled back and stood staring at what she'd become. Purple veins, like dried up tributaries, spread across the sallow topography of her chest. The twin peaks of her clavicle threatened to puncture her skin with each labored breath. Her dark doe eyes held me in their watery gaze, boring into me, feral and pleading. What are you talking about? I snapped. You're not dead. Instantly, I realized how bothered I sounded, how annoyed. My mother was dying, and all I was worried about was getting enough sleep and that I had to go to work in a couple of hours. 6 months earlier, before we had any inkling my mother was ill, my partner Jenny and I made a 3-hour trip from Pittsburgh to Dunkirk, New York, to spend the weekend with her. It was July, a couple weeks before my 47th birthday. My mother was feeling good, so we decided to go for a drive. The air smelled of fresh-cut grass, wildflowers, and diesel. Vineyards rose and fell to our right, while on the left, the cement-gray waters of Lake Erie passed in and out of view like the back of a whale. My mother rolled her window down and let the wind sweep across her face while Bob Dylan crooned from the CD player, "Someday, baby, you ain't gonna worry about me anymore." We drove through Silver Creek and the Seneca Reservation to Athol Springs, where we sat outside on a restaurant patio overlooking the lake. The Buffalo and Lackawanna skylines in the distance. A flock of white windmills stood on the shore where, when I was a child, the mills of Bethlehem Steel towered and spewed dark fumes of smoke and grime. Jenny and my mother ordered porterhouse steak with mashed potatoes, while I had walleye, coleslaw, and fries. My mother and I posed for a photograph, our shoulders leaning into one another, our smiles wide. 2 years before that summer day, my mother suffered a stroke. We were in the habit of talking on the phone at least 3 times a day, sometimes more. I called her during my lunch break and while walking to the bus stop after work. She called to tell me what was happening in Dunkirk, what she'd heard on the news, and to remind me it was my turn to play at Scrabble. Yet she waited 2 days before mentioning that she might have had a stroke. It was a Friday in May. I called several times, but she didn't answer. The day before, she sounded groggy, a bit confused. She told me she had a terrible headache and was going to bed. You can call me later, she said, but I might not answer. When she finally did answer, about 3:30 the following afternoon, her voice slurred. I think I had a stroke, she said. Last night? No, Wednesday. I hung up and called the Dunkirk police. That night, I drove to Erie, Pennsylvania, where she had been taken by ambulance to Hammett Hospital. My mother had suffered an ischemic stroke due to a buildup of plaque in her carotid arteries. Even though she hadn't received immediate care, care that may well have prevented her from losing the use of her left arm, she was lucky. Her mind wasn't affected. She remained sharp and quick-witted as ever. Even her sarcasm was intact. Doctors put a stent in one of her arteries and released her after a few days. They suggested she go to rehab, but my mother refused. She was adamant about going home to her apartment. With the help of a walker, a home health aide, and an unyielding determination, she managed to live on her own a few more years, hiding behind a facade of independence and fearlessness. Now my mother was truly dying, and all I could do was watch her die. She moved in with us 3 weeks earlier, leaving her beloved apartment in the town she grew up in behind. That summer day along the lake seemed a lifetime ago. As I stood over her, the early morning sky outside the window transforming from black to a dull chrome, I watched my mother watching me and tried to turn away, embarrassed and frightened by my sudden outburst of anger and the truth I refused to accept. Images of Kafka's Hunger Artist flashed in my mind and I grew dizzy. Everything moved in slow motion, distorted somehow, like we were being pulled by some centrifugal force. It was how I'd felt as a child on the operating table when the doctor put the ether mask over my mouth and the lights grew so bright I thought their radiance might swallow me. "Get this body out of here," she yelled. Had she been dreaming? Had the cancer spread to her brain? There were signs, but maybe I ignored them. Now she was convinced that she had already died and her corpse left before her on the bed. "You're not dead," I said, as if trying to convince myself. "Take my pulse, then." I took her hand in mine and pressed my finger to her wrist where the vein bulged. "Well," she said, as if she knew the answer. When I admitted I couldn't find a pulse, she smirked. It was a look that she'd given on nights in my 20s when I'd come home drunk, insisting I'd only had a beer or two. A look that says, "Who do you think you're talking to? I'm your mother, remember?" It was a look that said, "See, I told you so." Thank you. And this chapter takes place in 1980, so it just goes back and forth in time. This is called Blaze of Glory. Music could always be heard in our house. Before the oldies station on my mother's TV, there were records, LPs and 45s that my parents listened to. We used to have a small turntable that looked like a suitcase, which sat on the wall-length bookshelf in my father's study. He even ran one of the speaker wires through the drop ceilings into the bathroom so my mother could listen to music while she took a shower. I remember sitting on the floor watching my parents dance to Chubby Checker's The Twist, their bodies bending and gyrating as Checker called out, "Round and round and up and down we go," like a shaman, beckoning them to partake in this ritual of body and soul, while Joe Macho's bass kept the beat and Georgie Young burped arpeggios on the sax. After my father moved out, my mother transformed his study into a music room. Gone were his roll-top desk, his commemorative plate from the televangelist Oral Roberts, a framed picture of a chimp dressed in a three-piece suit. Gone were his stock charts that looked like EKG readings. Gone were his lottery magazines and thick tomes on economics, all of which he studied like scripture. In their place, my mother dragged the tattered yellowed love seat from the living room. She hung a poster of Elvis and a painting of Jesus exposing his sacred heart. She opened the curtains, hung spider plants and ferns in the bay window, and sprayed something that smelled like the lilac tree in our backyard. During this time, it had become my job to wake my mother each morning so she could help me get ready for school. Her clock radio went off at 7:15 a.m., and I'd hobble into her bedroom. The clock was only a few inches from her head on the nightstand, but it could have been down the street, for she never heard it. "Mom, it's time to get up," I'd shout. 5 more minutes, she'd beg, her eyes momentarily springing open. Then she'd turn over, pull the covers over her head, and groan, "Please, just give me 5 more minutes." I'd press the snooze button and run into the kitchen, turn on the Mr. Coffee Maker, and then make her toast slathered with butter and powdered cinnamon. One December morning, I hobbled into my mother's bedroom and called her as usual. Instead of pressing the snooze button, I stood and listened to the radio announcer, who sounded as if he'd been crying. John Lennon was assassinated outside his apartment in New York City last night, he said. He was 40 years old. I had no idea who this guy Lennon was, but the word assassinated filled me with a mix of fear and excitement. It sounded so adult, so cool. All that day, and for the next few weeks, the radio and TV were abuzz about him and his band, the Beatles. The accused killer, Mark David Chapman, was a Beatles fan who flew all the way from Hawaii just to shoot Lennon. They said two bullets struck the left side of Lennon's back, and one lodged in his aorta, virtually destroying the major blood vessels above his heart on impact. A week later, my cousin and Aisha watched the televised memorial service. Thousands of people had gathered outside the Dakota. They stood crying and singing Lennon's songs, Give Peace a Chance and Imagine. As with the film The Lincoln Conspiracy, which a few years earlier, I begged my mother to take me to, wanting only to witness Lincoln's brains fly out of his head like a horror movie, I became obsessed with the gory details of Lennon's murder and often dreamed of being assassinated myself. These bloody fantasies filled my waking dreams, and I often found myself narrating the story of my own death. Irwin was found riddled with bullets, my reporter's voice said in front of the bathroom mirror, or the killer attacked Irwin with a hatchet. Was I psychotic? Was my obsession with being murdered some kind of internalized martyr complex that I learned from my mother? Did it foreshadow, along with my bloody magic marker drawings of Jesus being crucified, or the G.I. Joe figures that I cut up and set fire to, some future violence? Or was I no different from other boys my age who'd fallen in love with death, or at least the idea of it? I also became obsessed with everything Lennon and the Beatles, and found a copy of Revolver among my mother's record collection, hidden between Elvis and Barry Manilow. Even though I couldn't articulate how, I knew that everything in my life had changed. It was as if with Lennon's death, I was reborn, and my destiny had been revealed. I no longer wanted to be a firefighter, the quarterback for the Buffalo Bills, or Rocky Balboa. I'd be a rock star one day and go down in a blaze of glory. Why else had I been born? Why else had I survived so many hospitalizations and surgeries? Thank you.